Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Good morning, Valley Forge, and all across the internet. Welcome to We the People, the Constitution Matters. I'm your host, Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative. Today I have with me our regular commentators, Mr. Phil Duffy, Instructor of the Constitution at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, and Pastor David Whitney will be joining us. He's the Senior Instructor at the Institute on the Constitution in Pasadena, Maryland. Last week, you may recall, we had Mr. Duffy explaining what the Lifelong Learning Institute program was all about and how he became involved with it as a teacher of the Constitution and some other subjects. And we learned that Osher is a nationwide program with programs in 50 states, 119 different locations around the nation. And you can find out information about them at www.osherfoundation.org. Toward the end of last week's show, Phil and I began discussing how best to rein in the ever-growing power of the federal government. We agreed that certain key clauses, like the General Welfare Clause and the Commerce Clause, for instance, have been so liberally interpreted over the years by the Supreme Court as to render them essentially limitless. Beginning in the 1930s, the court has been saying that the federal government can spend money on nearly anything, whether that expenditure is aimed at benefiting the welfare of specific individuals or groups or the general public. And they can also regulate any aspect of commercial businesses, regardless of whether the products of that company were ever intended to cross state lines. So we have a very different constitution in effect today, thanks to the Supreme Court. Now, let me pause here to remind our listeners, whether you're hearing this over the radio or over the internet, you can call in questions at any time. Throughout the show, the call-in number is 610-539-TALK. That's 610-539-8255. And if you call in a question during the first 30 minutes of the show, we will send you a free pocket constitution in the mail. Just leave your name and address with us, and we'll make sure you get that. Also, if the call-in line is busy, you can email us your question by sending it to info@1180.com, info@1180.com. And once again, be sure to include your mailing address so we can get you that pocket constitution. We'll have somebody monitoring email throughout the show. Also like to thank our sponsors, Valley Forge PC Repair and ShopRite, for making this the shortest hour of my life possible. So let's get on to our topic today. How do we best rein in the growing power of the federal government? I'm going to start things off by asking Phil Duffy to explain why amending the Constitution is the appropriate way to do that. Phil?
Gary, let's start by considering why nations have constitutions. It's not to empower government. A governing class doesn't need a constitution. George Washington put it succinctly, government is not reason, it's not eloquence, it is force. Like fire, a troublesome servant and a fearful master. Never for a moment should it be left to irresponsible action. Government is an abstraction. Its real face is a class of people who wield power, a minority who use the concept of government to enforce its will on a majority. In the beginning of recorded history, there was no distinction between the use of pure force and government. They were the same. It was only when the majority caught on and combined, that things began to change is when the barons assembled at Runnymede to force the Magna Carta on King John. Constitutions are designed to protect the people against the inherent tyranny of the governing class. Only secondarily do they grant enumerated powers to the governing class. Let me emphasize the people we send to Washington as their so-called representatives and the people they appoint to powerful offices like the Supreme Court are typically members of the governing class. What motivates them is different from what motivates you and me. If there is a career bias to the profession of politics, it is the attraction to power. The framers of our Constitution understood that, and that is why they provided two ways to amend the Constitution. Proposals by Congress, which is how the current 27 amendments changed the original Constitution, and a convention of the states. Guess which route will be more successful in reining in the power of the federal government? Congress is not likely to propose amendments that would rein in its power. We have a third alternative, and that is to settle for no constitutional change. And there are times when no change is justified. But who can say that the last 102 years have demonstrated that our Constitution is protecting us against the governing class? Even those with short memories have to be impressed with the expansion of federal power over the past decade. How many decades will pass at this rate before we are nothing more than nominal free men, but slaves in reality? And forget the idea that an opposition party will successfully get virtuous people elected and they will bail us out. Both parties are led by people who have a severe attraction to power. They aren't going to represent us. They will represent their own interests. If we want our Constitution to protect us, there is only one reasonable route open to us, convening a convention of the states. That is the only route that takes Congress out of the picture, letting the states determine what our Constitution should say. I'll grant the opposition's argument that a runaway convention is possible. Once a convention of the states is called, everything in the current Constitution could technically be changed, with one exception. No state, without its consent, shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. But because of the three-fourths ratification rule, a mere 13 states could block the runaway convention. If that is so, what are the chances that 38 states would agree on amendments that would be proposed in a convention? Frankly, slim. But that could be determined by the amendments that are proposed. The list of proposed amendments will need to be short, understandable, principled, and popular. And that rules out amendments such as the balanced budget, which are complex, controversial, and essentially political placebos. While it will be important to propose the best amendments that will address the structural flaws in the current Constitution, we need to be realistic about successfully amending the Constitution, at least in round one of the process. We need to face the fact that the electorate is essentially ignorant of the Constitution and its purpose. The primary goal of the convention supporters ought to be elevation of the Constitution into a national discussion. The secondary goal is to send a signal to the violators of the Constitution in Washington that the natives are restless and it's only a matter of time before they come to get them. If we get some amendments through in round one, that will be a bonus. It is unfortunate that the most vocal and visible of convention supporters are those people who look at this mechanism as a means to push their favorite schemes for government improvement, usually a balanced budget, or term limits for representatives in Congress. Both proposals are like taking aspirin to cure cancer. Think of a patient doing something that stupid. In a couple of years, the stage one cancer, which was eminently treatable, has become stage three or four with virtually no options left for the patient. Politics is that way. We could implement both a balanced budget amendment and term limits for representatives. Several presidential election cycles could pass, and then the people would realize that the federal government is just as powerful and just as arbitrary as ever. So what's a person to do then? Give up on the Constitution altogether, of course. that does not seem like a very attractive route. I think it would be a mistake to call a convention of states now in the midst of the chaos of a presidential election season. But this is a great time to be discussing amendment proposals. We ought to have a sense for the types of proposals to be considered going into the convention. I'd like to suggest some principles in preparing for a convention. Avoid the panacea proposals. No single amendment will cure all of the ills of our government, but some will contribute to the solution more than others. Consider the five themes of the Constitution: federalism, separation of powers, checks and balances, pluralism, and representation. What do we need to do to return to those themes? Consider where wording has been subject to interpretation abuse, for example, the general welfare, interstate commerce, and the necessary and proper clauses. Avoid triggering an expansion of federal powers as a result of an emergency. This is the mistake the German people made in the Weimar Constitution, allowing Hitler to come to power. Put Articles 1 to 3 under the microscope. These are the articles that address each of the three branches of government. Note that only 17 to 20% of the effort went into Article 3 for the judicial branch, as went into Article 1 for the legislative branch. That looks like Article 3 was an afterthought, which could explain why we've been tyrannized by our Supreme Court. And finally, look closely at the history of the executive veto and how it makes a mockery of representative government. Did you know that the president's legislative power offsets 355 of our elected members of Congress? That is the definition of an imperial presidency. So that's not a complete list. We should consider alternatives and additions. My point is that the time has come to back away from politics and move towards statesmanship. We need to take a principled systems approach to understanding our Constitution's limitations if we are to create amendments that will secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity.
Well, that's a great rundown, Phil, and as I expected, a very measured and cautious approach to this idea. Let me address the 700-pound gorilla in the room, which is the idea of a runaway convention, or a convention that ends up, as some have termed it, shredding the Constitution or completely replacing it with another. How do you control a convention which everyone agrees, once it convenes, can set its own rules of procedure and then operate under those rules? So the Convention of the States Project, which is a project of the Citizens for Self-Governance, has come up with this approach. 34 states would submit applications to Congress that call for exactly the same sort of measured convention, one which would only be allowed to consider amendments which fit three different criteria. Either they impose fiscal restraints on the federal government, they reduce the size and jurisdiction of the federal government, or they impose limits on the terms of its officials. And the idea is that 34 states would, of course, constitute a supermajority at a convention of 50 states. Now, the 34 applications are going to be identical, but that's not a constitutional requirement. Why would they do that? Well, we've had over the years far more than 400 different applications for a convention, and yet one has never been called. Why is that? Because these applications have been all over the board in terms of their focus. Some have called for a balanced budget amendment. Some have called for a convention for term limits amendments. Some have called for a convention for the purpose of enacting what became the 17th Amendment. So Congress has never convened a convention, and the feeling is because the applications have been for various and sundry things and not focused on one specific sort of convention, limited to considering only certain subject matter amendments. So that would be step one, to find 34 states willing to submit an application very tightly worded along these lines. Now, only four states have done this. So there's a long way to go yet before we are anywhere near convening such a convention. But 34 states means that 34 of those states would have to be states that are currently under Democratic control in the state legislatures. So the 30 states that are in Republican control might constitute the bulk of this effort, but at least four states that are currently under Democratic control would have to join this effort in order for it to succeed. But the feeling is that once these 34 states submit their applications and Congress does enact or act on them as required by the Constitution, then those 34 states would instruct their delegates according to the applications. That is, the delegations of these 34 states would be constrained by their instructions to only voting on proposed amendments which fit this criteria. This is the chief safety mechanism of such a convention. And as we look back to 1787, we find that this is exactly what was done then as well. Each state sent with its delegations instructions as to what they were to do and what they were not to do. And to dispute the runaway convention myth, almost every one of the 12 delegations that attended was enabled or empowered to do whatever was necessary to render the federal Constitution, the Articles of Convention, Articles of Confederation, adequate to the needs of the Union, adequate to the exigencies of the Union. So in almost every case, at least 10 cases out of the 12 delegations that attended, the delegations were widely empowered to do whatever is necessary to render the federal Constitution adequate to the needs of the Union. And we would hope that the 34 states in the modern era that sent these applications in would similarly instruct their delegates. Now, it's recognized generally that you cannot constrain how a delegate can vote on a particular matter. That is a matter of conscience protected by the First Amendment. And so a delegate, once something is up for a vote, would be permitted to vote any way he or she seems to be most appropriate. But you can limit what a delegate can vote on, not how he votes, but what he votes on. And that's where the instructions to the delegations would be so critical. They could only vote on amendments which fit the criteria that we have outlined. And that is then to prevent the convention from deviating into areas which are beyond the scope of the applications. For instance, if some liberal delegation would propose on the floor of the convention that a amendment be submitted which requires the federal government to guarantee to every citizen a home, this would obviously be an amendment that would not fit the threefold criteria of the Convention of the States project, and it would therefore be ruled out of order. And the delegates of those 34 states would be constrained from even voting on such an amendment because it would be outside their instructions. So there's the safety that we would hope would be in place, and it would prevent the convention from deviating into areas of constitutional law or social policy even that would be beyond the scope of those applications. We, as I said, have had over 400, another source says 800 applications over the years, and Congress has never yet called a convention. They came very close in 1913. In 1913, the applications came within one state of requiring a convention to consider an amendment that would allow senators to be popularly elected. So rather than wait for that 34th application to arrive, or the two-third application to arrive, Congress sent the amendment being requested out to the states for ratification. The feeling generally is that Congress does not want a convention, that out of that convention could come some amendments which limit their power and limit their jurisdiction, impose fiscal restraints on them, And so these are the kinds of amendments that would not be proposed by Congress itself. These were the kind of amendments that could only be proposed through a convention of the states. So, Phil, what do you have any response to that?
Well, I think there are two parts to this that I would comment on. The first is the necessity for instructions prior to the delegates going to the convention itself. And I think that's consistent with the educational goal here. The more of that preparation that goes on, the more that gets into the media, the more general education that would occur amongst the electorate. And that's a great idea. You can't have too much preparation. I would hope that during that process that we would narrow down the amendments to those that make the most sense, that are the most principled, that are simple, concise, and complete, and most reasonable people could look at these and say, yes, they make sense. I think we should distinguish between what the Constitution's language says and what is precedent here in terms of how delegates vote. I could picture in the worst case, let us say, that somebody was instructed to vote in a certain way and or to abstain from voting in a certain way, and that they did that in spite of their instructions. Who would rule them out of order? Well, it depends upon the rules that exist for the convention itself, which would be determined by the delegates, I would assume. So technically, it is possible that a vote could get through that is counter to the instructions. But on the other hand, I don't see anything that prevents the state from then withdrawing their delegate and replacing that delegate. And the point is that the vote would stand in that case. Now, bear in mind that I'm looking purely at the constitutional language, not at the precedent, which I believe you're talking about, Gary. And there's a great deal of precedent for acting according to the rules.
Yes, and the final bit of safety that I would mention comes in the fact that anything that results from this convention, whether it has been constrained by the 34 delegations and their rather narrow instructions, or whether it's something else has been allowed to be voted on and resulted in a majority vote, no matter what emits from the convention, it must still be ratified by 38 states, by three-quarters of the states, in order to become part of the Constitution. That is, 13 states are all that is necessary to block anything that doesn't make sense from becoming a part of the Constitution. And that's the additional safety measure that would keep this process from, you know, wrecking or in some way weakening the Constitution any further than it has already been weakened by hundreds of Supreme Court decisions. So that's another bit of safety that I failed to mention, but is very, very important to this process. So there's the idea of how to constrain a constitution, a convention to limited, to considering limited amendments. And I agree with you, Phil, that this would be a wonderful, wonderful opportunity to get people involved in the Constitution, to get them learning about the Constitution. It would be on the nightly news, and everyone would be discussing it. It would be the greatest benefit to constitutional education we've ever had. So for that measure, I look forward to this with great eagerness.
Yeah, I think we see from the attendance that we're getting at Constitution classes, which has been good since 2008, I believe, but has slackened off a bit, that we're just getting to the tip of the iceberg here. We need to do more education.
And we're going to have to take a short break here, so we'll see you on the other side in just a moment to continue our discussion of a convention of the state.
We'll be right back. liberty right here in Philadelphia. Broadcasting freedom shining light throughout the tri-state area. Streaming freedom shining light from Philly to the nations. 1180 shining forth, we are the Freedom Station. WFYN.
News Radio. I'm Chris Foster. North Korea gives South Korea until tomorrow to stop propaganda broadcasts across the border or face military action. The sides exchanged artillery fire yesterday.
The immediate build-up to this goes back to the 4th of August. Two South Korean soldiers were very badly injured in a landmine incident. The North absolutely denies any involvement. But in response, the South Korean side resumed its loudspeaker broadcasting.
Sky News correspondent Katie Stollard. It's graduation day at Fort Benning, Georgia, for the first women to finish Army Ranger School.
First Lieutenant Shay Haver and Captain Kristen Greist proved over 2 months of stress, hunger, and fatigue that they could be among the elite of the Army. Greist and Haver will graduate alongside 94 men, but while they've earned the right to wear the black and gold Ranger crest, they can't operate as part of the active Ranger regiment.
Fox's Grinnell Scott, Fox News. We report, you decide.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Hey, Grandma, I'm confused. We're reading an article the New York Times wrote in 1999 in my Common Core book about the fall of the Berlin Wall. Didn't you tell me Ronald Reagan was mostly responsible for the fall of the Soviet Union?
Well, yes, I did.
Well, right here in the article, it says Mikhail Gorbachev did that. When I told them I thought it was Ronald Reagan, my teacher said no, that he was a president then, but he was just a good salesman. It was Gorbachev who was the great reformer who transformed the world. Boy, I'm glad they talked about that, because I would have gotten it wrong on the test.
Oh, honey, that was just an article from an old biased newspaper. I was there, and you can trust me. Oh, what are they going to teach you next? These Common Core lessons are awful.
Learn more about the Federal Common Core and PA Core standards and call your representatives today and ask them to stop the national takeover of education. Go to knowpacommoncore.com or call Richard at 484-678-2236. Pennsylvanians Against Common Core brought you this message.
Welcome back to We the People, the Constitution Matters. And do we have David Whitney on the line with us yet? Doesn't sound like it. So we do have a caller, an old friend, Claude Dunn from Fredericksburg, Virginia. So I'm going to ask our station attendants to patch Claude in so Claude can ask a question. Our very first one on We the People, the Constitution Matters.
Hello?
Hello? Gary?
Yes.
Yes. I'll let David Whitney speak to the issue of why the Constitutional Convention is a bad idea, but I would like to suggest that the Constitution itself provides a much better solution to our current problem, and that is that, and that every person that is in a position of carrying out orders takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution, therefore declaring that they will, in fact, nullify any laws, rules, or regulations that come down that do not match the what's in the Constitution from their understanding of the Constitution. If all elected officials understood that. All members of the military certainly do. As you and I both took a oath to support the Constitution. This means that we have a duty to nullify any law, rule, regulation that comes down that says that we have to do something that's going to violate our understanding of the Constitution. And that was, last time I know that was done and spoken about was in the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. But those folks definitely got in trouble there when they carried out unlawful orders. And we need to educate people as to the safeguard that is built into the Constitution, and that provides all the solutions and educational opportunity with none of the inherent dangers with calling a constitutional convention.
Well, I recognize that, and that's certainly an important feature of the Constitution. The oath of office is incredibly important, but here's the rub. What does support and defend mean? You know, you and I have an understanding of what that means, but we have seen numerous examples of government officials who have done things that, to our eyes at least, would contravene that support and defend admonition. That apparently they have come to a different understanding of what support and defend means, or they've come to a different understanding of what the Constitution means, and their attempt to support it has resulted in something very different than what the founders would have intended. So there's the danger. I mean, not the danger per se, but the weakness of depending on the oath of office as a means of maintaining constitutional government. It's up to interpretation, just like the Commerce Clause and the General Welfare Clause have been. Do you not agree, Claude?
Well, I understand what you're saying, but I think our problem today is that people in office, whether it's elected or appointees, do not understand that they have a role and a duty to not obey unconstitutional orders as they understand the Constitution. And if the general public had this understanding, I think we'd have a lot more people standing up to tyranny coming through the people that are trying to act like dictators in the federal government, saying, well, you got to obey the law. Well, everybody that takes an oath has a duty to interpret the law according to the Constitution, and they need to be a student of the Constitution. People don't understand that today. It's not taught in school.
Well, that's true, and I
agree. That needs to go on to regain control of our government. That's what
I agree wholeheartedly that education is absolutely an essential requirement to getting us back to constitutional government. Yes, the general public has only a vague notion of what the Constitution says and means, and this has been demonstrated in numerous polls. You know, 33% of Americans can't even name the three branches of government. So that's another idea or another benefit of this constitutional convention issue, is that as we get closer to this actually happening, people are going to take a rabid interest in their Constitution. If we could find some way of generating that kind of interest right now, today, and fill our classes at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute or Constitution Leadership Initiative classes or Institute on the Constitution classes, if those could be filled today, then we would be well on the road to returning to constitutional government. But as you and I know, that's just not high on people's interest right now. They're much more interested on Dancing with the Stars.
Well, if all this interest that's been spent on calling a constitutional convention was in turn spent on trying to educate people and show the importance of education, perhaps we could make a huge difference. And once people start realizing that they actually have control of their government, the greatest vote, as you well know, is in the fourth branch of government, which is the jury system. And here the elected and appointed representatives of government have no authority over we the people, and that the jury is totally independent and can rule as they understand the Constitution, and no one can override them when they vote not guilty.
Well, true, and the jury system is another aspect of constitutional government that most people do not understand today and definitely needs to be part of an educational system. But you said that, you know, if we spend as much time trying to get people educated as we do arguing this Article 5 question, we'd be further along. Well, I'm not spending any more time arguing this than I could spend on educating the people. We can't get people to give us a Saturday to conduct a constitutional seminar. We can't get people to give us a series of weekday nights to study the Constitution. Phil, here's a question for you. What is the typical attendance in your Constitution seminars or at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute?
Well, I've had as few as six people, had more than that under other circumstances. But you're talking about hundreds of thousands of people in this area alone who potentially could attend those sessions. So perhaps over several years, I've reached maybe 200 to 250 people.
Well, yes, and so we've got 325 million people in the United States, the majority of which know little to nothing about the Constitution. And every June, we're pumping out three million more high school graduates who are equally illiterate about their Constitution. So it's an uphill battle to consider that we're ever going to educate enough people to really be conversant on this topic.
Gary, can I make a point here? After 102 years, and I think we need to go back to 1913 as the turning year, if you will. But after 102 years, we have to be pragmatic about the direction that things are going in. And I think the best example of that is look how Common Core is being adopted. Common Core is unconstitutional. I mean, it's based upon a whole pack of lies. It was not adopted by the states, because being adopted by the states would mean that the legislatures of these states would pass these programs and say this is part of the law. But that's where we're at. And there was an ad about the Common Core that was fascinating about the coverage of the implosion of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War, and how that story has been twisted as a part of this Common Core program. So we have to be pragmatic at this point. Yes, we are reaching a very, very limited number of people with Constitution education, but we are not getting to nearly enough people in order to turn back the tide. And in order to do that, we need a catalyst. We need a catalyst, and the convention is a catalyst.
So I'll pose the question back to Claude. Claude, you've tried to teach the Constitution using the Institute on the Constitution's course. How do you attract enough people to educate enough people so that we can make a difference in terms of our understanding as a nation of this founding document? How do you do it?
Well, as I was saying, the catalyst could be if all the money and effort that's spent into pushing for a constitutional convention was turned into promoting classes on the Constitution and explaining the aspect we're talking about of nullification. And this is the duty of all of our elected officials, and people started to understand that and talking about that and understand that when they elect people, that this should be one of the criteria. Are you going to live up to your oath of office and block everything that's unconstitutional? I think we could make a huge inroads into solving the problem without any of the potential dangers of calling a constitutional convention.
Well, the programs are out there. You know as well as I that the educational programs are out there, but you can't get people to come to them. How do you generate enough interest in the people that they see the need to become educated? It's not a matter of we're devoting our resources inappropriately to this Convention of the States issue. The central question is, how do you get people interested in learning about their Constitution? What is the method that will yield success, that will yield full classes, that will yield interest in learning about their Constitution?
Well, we the people have got to make an issue with our elected, as we elect representatives. And there's a lot of money behind calling for a constitutional convention. What I'm saying is that that same money and effort was put into educating people as to the proper duty of every elected official, everybody that's in office of that carries a gun of enforcement, all take an oath to uphold and support the Constitution. And in that is the inherent obligation to nullify all law, rules, and regulations that violate their conscience when it comes to enforcing the Constitution. That's the uniqueness of the American system. That was the great protector we have of our liberties. Is that
We've got another call-in caller, a Mark in Tennessee. Are you with us, Mark?
Yes, I am, Gary. Thanks for having me on. I was listening to your conversation about a convention, and I'm just wondering, you know, any idea that CD is brought before Congress is typically from one party or the other. When in the history of the United States has there been 34 states that have been one party or the other that would actually have a chance of actually coming together and making this happen? It seems like an unlikely event to me. Thanks for having me.
I'm having trouble. We're getting some feed over from another feed, and I'm having trouble understanding what your question was, Mark. Could you rephrase it?
Sure. Yeah. So I've been listening to your talk on the convention, and I'm just thinking that any law or amendment that would ever become before Constitution, having before Congress, would be seated from either one party or the other, either Democrat or Republican. So it seems unlikely that you'd ever have a case where you'd actually have 34 states that are all of one, of one particular political party, which seems like in these days would be necessary in order to get anything passed. Do you know, has there ever been the history of either one party or another, either Democrats or Republicans, controlling 34 states?
Well, we have 30 states in the control of Republican legislatures right now. And so for 34 to reach that two-thirds majority that would require a convention will require cooperation, at least currently, of four states that are under Democratic control. I don't know that we've ever had 34 states in the control of one particular party or the other, but as a historical measure, it's kind of not as important as the problem we face right now, which is only 30 states are in the control of the Republican Party, which you would think would be interested in this idea because it would allow the federal government to be reined in, which is a primary goal of, we would hope, of conservatives in the Republican Party. But so we have four states that if this was going to be held today, that are in Democratic control and would have to see something of value in joining this movement. Now, that are there Democrats today or Democratic legislatures in the states that are upset over the overreach of the federal government? I think there probably are, and for that matter, I would hope that at least four of them would be able to be willing to join this movement. Phil, what do you think about this Democrat versus Republican aspect of this? How important is that?
I suspect that if a convention of the states is going to be successful, and there are multiple levels of success, by the way, that we're going to have to move away from the idea of Democrat versus Republican. Ultimately, to get amendments that are acceptable to both parties currently, we're going to need to find the common ground amendments, those things that make sense. To me, one of the better ideas is the general welfare thing, because you can look at the general welfare language and how it's been distorted. You can go right back to Madison, and I believe it's the Federalist 39, where he said this idea of the expansionist view of the general welfare is an absurdity. So, you know, we could go back on a principled basis, and hopefully there'd be enough people on the Democratic side that would be of an orientation towards principles that you could have some common action. But I'd like to point out that these ideas that Claude has mentioned, we all agree with that. But these are not mutually exclusive ideas. You could simultaneously pursue education and a convention at the same time. No problem. In fact,
well, we are currently.
Yes. Those ideas support each other. You do need a catalyst after 102 years. Let's face it, we're going in the wrong direction right now. We're all aware of that. We need a catalyst to start to move things back in the right direction. And I think the caller from Tennessee's point is valid as well. But even if we don't get a convention of the states, the educational process and the so-called noise from the media that comes around this idea makes it worthwhile. It is a legitimate direction in which we should go.
Well, I would love to see full classes, and I agree with you, Phil, that this would be a catalyst to providing them as we approach, as people begin to see that this might actually happen. We're definitely going to see a renewed interest in learning about the Constitution and learning what it says. And Claude, we might even get people interested in attending the duty of the jury course or similar or state constitution courses. So it would be a great opportunity, even if the convention never actually happens. As we get close to what appears to be a convention, the interest in the people, by the people, in learning about the Constitution would definitely increase. Do you not agree?
Yes.
Well, so there would be at least benefit from that aspect. Even if the convention itself never occurs, we would have a side benefit of it. Phil's classes would be full, my classes would be full, David's classes would be full. People would be eager to learn more about their Constitution so they could put this whole convention thing in the proper perspective. And so there would be benefit from that, even if the convention never opens its doors. So I see this as a plus-plus. And as Phil pointed out, this is not a binary question. This is not whether we have a convention or we do the other things. We should be doing them all. We should be trying to elect better representatives. We should be trying to discern what is a better representative and do they have an originalist view of the Constitution. We should be trying to educate the people. And you and I are doing as much as we possibly humanly can in that regard, at least as far as the ideas that I've come up with. So this is not a either-or proposition. Let's do all these things, and let's try to get the country back on track. The question comes back inevitably to what are you going to do about a general welfare clause that the Supreme Court has says allows the Congress to spend money on anything, and what are you going to do about a commerce clause that the Supreme Court says allows the Congress to regulate any aspect of a business? You're not going to change those things through the education of the people. You're not going to change those things through electing better representatives. Those are structural defects that we now have in our Constitution that can only be remedied by taking the language of the Constitution and making it unambiguous, unmistakable as to original intent.
Gary, the only thing I would add is that have we ever had a program on nullification? This program is serving as a great educational tool as far as a constitutional convention, but has any effort been put into having a radio broadcast strictly on nullification, the benefits of that, the oath of office, the jury, the vote there, how this is independent of our current system and can solve these problems tomorrow?
Okay, Claude, there's your challenge to me. Next week's show, I'm announcing it right now, next week's show is devoted to the issue of nullification. And in preparation for that, I will ask everyone that is our regular listeners to go out to the 10th Amendment Center's website and start reading up on nullification. I think nullification is a great remedy for some aspects of federal overreach. But as we're going to see next week, nullification has severe limitations as well. But I'm willing, certainly, to devote next week's show to that. And Claude, I would invite you to come back on and discuss nullification with us. How's that?
Sounds good.
Okay, Phil, what do you think about the issue of nullification?
Oh, absolutely. And this is consistent with the point that I made earlier, that these are not mutually exclusive strategies. We ought to be pursuing all of these strategies simultaneously as they are appropriate, as they suggest that give a success. And I'll add another one. Let's whip out Henry David Thoreau's Civil Disobedience and start to read that. And let's ponder about how civil disobedience can be used to prevent the illegal and unconstitutional overreach of the federal government. All strategies that work, should be pursued. They are complementary.
I agree completely. Well, we've got a couple things I want to mention here in the closing. There are some upcoming events that I think people who have tuned into this show regularly would be interested in, and I do want to take a couple moments to mention them. On this next Monday, August 24th, the Foundation for American Christian Education in Chesapeake, Virginia, has a Lessons for Liberty series, and we'll be hosting Dr. Carlton McLeod, pastor of Chesapeake Revival Church, who's going to speak on restoring the biblical family. Another very worthy goal and long overdue. To participate in this event, you don't have to go to Chesapeake, Virginia. You can participate via live stream. Just go on to www.faceface.net, and there you'll find a place to register for that event. There's a $5 nominal charge. On September 11th, our own David Whitney, who for some reason wasn't able to join us today, is going to be speaking at the Institute on the Constitution at 8028 Ritchie Highway, Suite 315 in Pasadena, Maryland, on the topic, is an Article 5 convention the last hope for America or a dangerous idea? It will be a $10 charge for that event if you want to attend either in their classroom or via a live webcast. And then finally, on Constitution Day, September 17th, Thursday, September 17th, once again, the Foundation for American Christian Education will be hosting a Lessons for Liberty series. Dr. Herb Titus, formerly the Dean of Regent University Law School, will speak on what should Christians do about the Obergefell versus Hodges decision. We're talking about civil disobedience, as Phil mentioned. You may learn that is part of should be part of our strategy as well. This will be a $5 charge to participate in that, but you can do it via livestream.com anywhere in the world. We actually have people connect to us from Australia to these events. So there's some upcoming events that I think people should be interested in. And let me just leave you with this. Ladies and gentlemen, it's your Constitution. You are we the people. It's not someone else's problem. And if you don't like what's happening in this country, if you don't like the continual erosion of our liberties, you need to do something about it. Get educated. Get involved. It's that simple. Together, we can turn things around. So we'll see you next week on We the People, the Constitution Matters. Bring a friend.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.